service.
I'd like to.
But there's one thing. All of these men right here have their DD-214s, which is given to men who are released from active duty. And on this DD-214, it has their years of service in Vietnam and some of the medals they were awarded. I think that's sufficient. Okay, would you, by a show of...
Just a little bit further on that. After the gentleman come down here, all the information will be made available. The press will be allowed to look at their copies of the DD-214s, which is a release from active duty. And as Scott said, proof that they were in Vietnam in the Marine Corps with the 1st Marine Division.
I'd like to, about this signing this paper thing, I want to know myself, and I imagine a lot of people, are we going to be given statements signed by personnel from the Pentagon, chiefs of staff, stating that these things, that they say that these did not happen? I mean, are we going to be given the same treatment? I mean,
I was talking about when they were marking to see who could throw the gooks the farther, was done on the ground, because it's hard to mark them from 3,000 feet. However, it was an official policy. After every mission you fly, you have to fill out an after mission report to show them all the good stuff you did during the day, like how many pounds of rice you carried and how many Americans and how many gooks you carried. Well, we were given very specific oral orders from the colonel on down. When you're carrying VCS, Vietcong suspects, you don't count them when they get in the airplane. You count them when they get out of the airplane, because the numbers don't always jive. And if one of them happens to get scared of heights and decides to get out, or something like that, or if he looks like maybe he's going to try and raise some shit in the belly of the aircraft and the crewman has to kick him out, that's none of your business. That didn't really happen, because you counted the men when they got off.
Did you ever witness anyone being...
Is there anybody who witnessed...
In regard to that question, another method they use in regard to helicopters is sometimes when they capture suspected enemy people, they might take them for a joyride. They usually tie them up and put a blindfold on them, and they'll put maybe three guys in a C-53. And they'll fly off, and they'll ask the guys in the air, you know, what is your unit and all this jive. And if they don't cooperate, they just might take one of them and say, okay, take off the blindfolds to the other two dudes and just shove them right out. Now, this is like, I don't know if this gives us a psychological edge, because apparently it works, because when the other two guys come down to the ground, I mean, they're scared shitless and they cooperate more readily than they ever would before.
Mr. Camille, you had some actual instances of observations of Vietnamese being thrown out of helicopters.
On Operation Stone, I was on the ground, and I didn't see that this Vietnamese was pushed out, but I did see him come flying out and land over where we were.
Perhaps he decided to take a little walk or something. I have an announcement. The 1st Air Cav and the 3rd Marines... 3rd Marine Division, would you meet in the vets room for a conference after this is over, please? And more questions?
Could you elaborate on the circumstances of the killing of the 4 ABA nurses?
The question was directed to Mr. Bishop in reference to the killing of the 4 NVA nurses.
I didn't get into this in the test. I didn't say it in the testimony, but it's written on my testimony. The operation was Mead River. It was a very large-scale operation. ROC Marines were involved, who were Korean Marines. Marines were involved. The Army was involved, and ARVNs were involved. A cordon was set up outside of Da Nang, and a big squeeze was put on right outside the airport. There were quite a few body counts as far as the enemy went. It was something like 1,300. There was quite a few American, the Allies had something like 700 or 800 so-called dead. We never knew, but part of the operation, we had just got through making heavy contact, and we went through a bunker system. It was a large bunker system. We found hospitals, And we came across four NVA nurses that were hiding out in one of the bunkers. They were nurses. We found medical supplies on them. They had black uniforms on. The Rock Marines came up to us, one of their officers, and they asked us if they could have the NVA nurses, that they would take care of them because we were sweeping through the area and that we couldn't take care of any POWs. So I imagine instead of killing them, we handed them over to the Rock Marines. Well, we were still in the area when the Rock Marines started tying them down to the ground. They tied their hands to the ground. They spread eagled them. They raped them. They raped all four. There was like maybe 10 or 20 Rock Marines involved. They tortured them. They sliced off their breasts. They took machetes and cut off parts of their fingers and things like this. And when that was over, they took the on all four, they took pop-up flares, which are it's an aluminum canister you hit with your hand. It'll shoot maybe 100, 200 feet in the air. They stuck them up their vaginas, all four of them, and they blew the tops of their heads off.
Forward so we can hear what you're saying, and we'll try our best to answer your question.
Well, he's coming up here. Does anybody know if they're going to show those slides of Mr. Camille? Does somebody know? Could you let us know?
Jim?
Okay. Are you going to show them now? Before there's any more questions, we'd like to show these slides. Mr. Camille, could
you narrate this?
Could you narrate the slides?
Okay, this is just a general picture of what the houses look like when we go through and throw our heat tablets in. They catch on fire very quickly, and there are people in these houses.
We get those house lights, please. We people can't see them.
The houses are made of grass, and they catch very quickly. And a lot of the times, if the people don't get out before we throw the heat tabs in, they don't get it out at all. This is a picture. We carried aces of spades, and it was kind of like a game. And when we kill someone, you plant an ace of spades on him, and you'd pose with the body because it was something really cool to do, to show everybody how many people you killed. These are bodies that attacked us at a place called Alpha North, and after we killed them, they were inside our position. And we threw them on trucks, we took them to the middle of the village, and we dumped them out in the middle and left them there like that. Well, we didn't treat any people, any bodies, like they were human bodies. It was just like throwing out garbage.
Excuse me, the next session will begin at 12:30, which is approximately 1/2 hour from now.
This is WBAI in New York City. Before we continue with the Winter Soldier investigation tapes, we'd like to remind you very briefly that WBAI is a listener-sponsored radio station, which means that we can broadcast material that other media won't or can't, what's worse, won't. And if you'd like to help listener-sponsored radio, our phone number is 826-0880. 826-0880. We continue now with the Winter Soldier investigation.
All right. Brothers and sisters, or sisters and brothers, I'd like to present to you the veterans from Vietnam that will be testifying about the atrocities that took place and created by American troops with the first Air Cav Division in Vietnam. To give you a little history on the 1st Air Cav Division, it is an air mobile division. It was the first created, and the 1st Air Cav was the first air mobile division to ever take place or to function in Vietnam. It arrived in Vietnam in 1965 in Quy Nhon. Now, I'd like to introduce you to the first testifier. Testimonial testifier. Mr. John, or former Captain John K. Mallory. Mr. Mallory?
I'm Jack Mallory. I served as a captain with the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, which during most of my time in Vietnam from May 1969 to May 1970 was under the operational control of the 1st Air Cavalry Division. I served as Regimental Assistant Civic Action Officer and Civic Action Officer for the 1st Squadron 11th Armored Cav. I'd like to say a few words about treatment of Vietnamese civilians by members of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. Destruction of crops and killing of domestic animals was common whenever the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment operated in populated areas. Crops were destroyed in the building of defensive positions, and animals were run over when the tracks, armored cars, tanks, ran through villages. Civilian deaths were quite frequent. Vietnamese civilians were killed accidentally when tracks and tanks running through their villages, often at excessive speeds, struck them, went off the road, ran into their houses, hit their bicycles, etc. On at least one occasion, the village of An Phu in Bin Long province was struck by artillery fired from Quan Loi base camp, causing several casualties. A civilian riding on an ox cart just south of Quan Loi base camp was intentionally struck by an American aircraft, which came in out of the sky, hit him in the head, traveled on. The man was killed. The aircraft was never identified. A helicopter, also never identified, dropped two white phosphorus grenades, these are incendiary grenades, into the village of Sa Trac, also in Binh Long province, burning down several buildings, burning two small Montagnard children. In Loc Ninh, a young boy about 12 years old was attacked by two American soldiers, severely beaten, and resulting in a broken arm. There is no reason known for this attack. On one occasion, a North Vietnamese Army nurse was killed by 11th Armored Cavalry troops. Subsequently, a grease gun of the type used in automotive work was placed in her vagina, and she was packed full of grease. On several occasions, enemy graves were violated, their skulls taken out of the graves, used as candle holders, conversation pieces. CS gas, better known as tear gas, was often used on civilians to chase them away from our positions where they came to sell or to look for valuable American trash in our trash dumps. On one occasion, this gassing of Vietnamese civilians was done by an American Army major. On another occasion, Vietnamese selling their wares in the area had their wares taken and destroyed by American troops led by two captains. One of them was myself. In August, in Binh Long province, north of An Lac, six friendly Vietnamese soldiers, civilian irregular defense group soldiers, were killed by helicopter gunships from the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. Although the CIDG area of operations was clearly marked on our tactical map in our tactical operations center, sheer carelessness of the duty officer from the 11th Armored Cav led him to give our gunships permission to fire at armed Vietnamese in the area, although it was quite well known that that there were friendly armed Vietnamese in that immediate vicinity. In general, U.S. attitudes towards Vietnamese civilians were not inhumane per se, but they were certainly not human. The Vietnamese civilians were regarded much as America regards her own minorities. A pat on the head for a trick, a kick in the ass for an imagined fault, and invisible the rest of the time.
Thank you, David. The next speaker, a former E5, James Duffy. James?
I served as a machine gunner on a CH-47 Chinook helicopter with Company A, 228th Aviation Battalion, 1st Air Cavalry Division, from February 67 to April 68. Most of our missions we flew alone, and we had a wide variety of missions. One such mission was a gas run, where we loaded the ship with 12 55-gallon drums of what I was told was CS gas, and we dropped it into a well-traveled path in the Anlo Valley. We were told that that gas would be effective for a number of weeks and remain there. Another mission was a defoliation run on our own perimeter in Ankei. That was the base camp at the time. The perimeter was occupied by GIs, grunts, pulling guard duty, and also the Vietnamese civilians from the neighboring town would go out to chop wood there. And so both our people and theirs were exposed to the defoliants. And when I first became a gunner, I was told the company policy was to return fire from all guns when fired on, to continue fire until our supply of ammo had been expended. This was usually 1,000-round belts that we kept in each of the two M60 machine guns, and also the crew chief, myself, and the flight engineer had M16s with as much ammunition as we wished to fire. It was quite very usual that there'd be a sniper outside a village in the foliage, in the trees, and if we'd take fire from one sniper, we'd return fire on that sniper and then continue to spray the entire village with machine gun fire and M16 ammunition until we either ran out of ammunition or we had flown so far away from the village that we could no longer reach them with the weapons. Now, the 1,000-round belts we used in the machine guns were usually straight tracer rounds. So during the dry season, the Vietnamese live in these hooches made out of sea ration cans and straw huts. And the tracers would set fire to the huts during the dry season. So the ones that we didn't get with ammunition, we could try and burn them out. The free fire zones were posted on the operation map in the operations tent. And this gave us a policy to kill anything that moved within that area. In one operation, I was flying into an LZ, and we took fire, and around hit one of our fuel pods. And one of the jobs of a crew member is also to pull maintenance on the ship. And the more maintenance you have to pull, the less flying time, and the less chance you get to kill gooks, because that's the mental attitude that the Army forces you into. So we were kind of mad that we had taken around in the fuel pod. So after leaving the LZ, we requested that the pilot fly over the area that we had taken the round from so we could get the whoever it was that had fired at us. And we were all pretty uptight about it. And as soon as we left the LZ, I noticed a contingent of Vietnamese peasants chopping wood. And I decided, well, if the Vietnamese can fire a ship into my, fire a round into my ship, then I can fire as many rounds into the Vietnamese as I want to. So I swung my machine gun on this group of peasants and opened fire. And fortunately, the gun jammed after one or two rounds, which was pretty, I was pretty lucky because this group of peasants turned out to be a work party hired by the government to clear the area, and there were GIs guarding them about 50 meters away. But my mind was so psyched out into killing gooks that I never even paid attention to look around and see where I was. I just saw gooks, I wanted to kill them. And I was pretty scared after that happened because that sort of violated the unwritten code that you can do anything you want to as long as you don't get caught. That's, I guess that's what's happened at the My Lai incident. Those guys just were following the same pattern that we've been doing there for 10 years, but they had the misfortune of getting caught at it. And rotor wash from a helicopter is a very effective, sadistic weapon. A Chinook helicopter is basically a cargo ship. That's what it's designed for. I forget the weight you can pick up with one, but when you've got a full load, you can put out a rotor wash at certain times. It approaches 100 miles an hour. And some of the things we used to like to do was in the morning, the people from hamlets and villages go out to a designated field to defecate. And if, when we'd be on an early morning mission, and we'd spot them, we'd make a swoop in, and we can get up to 120 knots, around 130 miles an hour. And as you swoop in with the ship, just as you approach them, the pilot would flare the ship on its tail, which means the rotor wash would spin around and hit the people, blowing them over through the sand in their own defecation. This was one of the things that we did for kicks. Excuse me, I lost my place here. Rotor wash was also used to blow down the huts, literally blow down their villages. Like I said, they're made out of straw and junk. So we come in and flare on a ship and just blow away a person's house. Also, the Vietnamese, when they've harvested a crop of rice, they put them out on these large pans to dry. And that harvest is what they maintain, you know, what's supposed to maintain them for that season, what they're supposed to live on. We'd come in and flare the ship and let the rotor wash blow the rice, blow their entire supply of food for that harvest over a very large area. And then, you know, laugh as we'd watch them running around trying to pick up individual pieces of rice out of a rice paddy over an area larger than this room. It was also used to spook water buffalo. The Vietnamese, when they plow their fields, the rice paddies, they follow, farming techniques where the rows of plants are fairly straight. And if we'd spot somebody plowing his field, we make a run on him. That'd spook the water buffalo. That water buffalo would take off in any old direction with that plow ripping up the field, and usually the farmer being dragged with the plow through the field. Once we were picking up a sling load of ammunition, and the Army had a habit of putting pickup zones and drop-off zones right near well-traveled roads, roads traveled by the local villagers. So we were hovering over this sling load of, I think it was howitzer rounds. And I was hanging out the window observing what appeared to be about, I guess he was about 12-year-old Vietnamese boy standing there watching us. And as we lifted up with the load, the rotor wash increased because of the weight, and it blew him into the path of a 2.5-ton truck with trailer, which killed him instantly. The psychological effect is something I'd like to bring out here to you people. When that happened, my first reaction, and my flight engineer, he was observing this too. Our first reaction was, I guess you'd call normal. It would be horror, pain. And then I realized that I caught myself immediately, and I said, no, you can't do that because you develop a shell while you're in the military. They brainwash you. They take all the humanness out of you. And you develop this crust which enables you to survive in Vietnam. And if you let that protective shell down, even for a second, it could mean that it's the difference between you flipping out or managing to make it through. And I caught myself letting the shell down, and I tightened up right away and started laughing about it and joking about it with the flight engineer. And he sort of moved on the same logic because I guess he caught it sort of knocked his shell down, too.
Excuse me, Duff. James. We're running out of considerable amount of time.
Right.
Quickly, could you go over the mistreatment of the POWs and the feeding of the Vietnamese the poisonous food?
Or right. All right. When we picked up POWs to transfer them to a POW camp, they'd be blindfolded and their hands would usually be tied behind their backs. On a few occasions, not often, I and other people would pistol whip them with our 45s, and when that wasn't cool to do because maybe we had a, you know, somebody flying the ship that really wasn't hip to how to off the gook, then we'd just kick them around as we walked around the ship. We also, on the ship, when we hit the LZ at times, we'd drop the ramp down halfway, and like I said, these people are blindfolded and tied, and walk them off the ramp, and it's literally like walking off this table blindfolded with your hands tied, so they just fall flat on their faces. Also, during test flights, we'd go to a specific area where the pilots could check out the controls, and this would attract a lot of Vietnamese. They would we'd throw out the sea ration cans that we didn't like, and after they thought they were getting a lot of food, we'd hand them cans of 5606, which is helicopter hydraulic fluid. It's very poisonous. And I observed one kid that I handed a can of hydraulic fluid, take a good healthy drink out of it before his mother knocked it out of his hand. And he was immediately sick right after that happened. In one incident, we were flying back from Quay Song Valley, and we took fire from 6 NVA, which caused the ship to explode in the air and make a crash landing. Now, on the way down, because our company policy was to just keep on firing, I had fired at all the military targets I could spot, and I looked out across the field, and I spotted a Vietnamese woman, a peasant, running away from the ship. I fired a burst of about 6 or 7 rounds into her back before we fired, before we hit the ground. When I was being questioned as to what happened, about 2 weeks later by a captain in my company, I told him what we did and what I did, and we both had a good laugh about it. That was pretty much company policy. Also, in Wei, during the Tet Offensive of 68, I observed American fighters and bombers, Phantoms, just dropping bombs and napalm into very crowded streets full of civilians. I mean, I don't know how many people were wiped out in that place. They blamed that on the NVA. Also, I was flying tail gun at the time on one mission into Wei, and just for kicks, the pilot told me to spray a house with my M16. It was occupied. Well, I don't know if the house was occupied, but the area was occupied by civilians. And this was common policy. You kill anything you want to kill, anytime you want to kill it. Just don't get caught.
Thank you. Is Kenneth Ruth an ex E-4 from the United States Army?
Right. My job in the service, I was a medic. I was attached out to different companies at different times. I just like to say that, you know, each of us could go on all day talking about atrocities that we witnessed. Now, every veteran in here, and it's not just the guys up here, each of us saw many and many of them that we all participated in. So I'm not going to run into a whole bunch that I saw. I just like to name a few. At one time, we were securing artillery, which means we set up a perimeter around them and protect them. And, you know, you might sit there for 4 or 5, 6, 7 days, and so we wanted to make sure our weapons were in order. So what you do, you test fire your weapons. Just shoot them off into for about 2 minutes or so into the distance. Well, we were told one day that we had to test fire our weapons and to prepare to do it. Well, many of us knew that on the other side of these bushes out in front of us was a whole village of people. And that if we did test fire our weapons, those people would be in jeopardy. So I approached the platoon leader and the platoon sergeant and told them this, that there were civilians on the other side of the village, of the bushes. And I was told, first of all, by the platoon leader that he just didn't care. And when I approached the platoon sergeant about it, he said that he'd shoot a mountain yard as fast as he would a Kong, so it didn't make any difference to him. This is, you know, nobody else cared. This is a general attitude. You know, Vietnamese aren't humans. They're targets. And one other thing I just like to point out is when I was one time attached out to the special forces, once in a while they needed a medic, and I usually volunteered, quote unquote, to go along with them. And one time, I have some slides of this. Can you show these slides? Well,
can we have those lights dim, please?
See this.